What the hell is wrong with you?
Morning, Cherry.
You think I wouldn't find out? You give me your word and then you pull this shit?
Keep your voice down, please. Let's talk in the conference room.
Hey, Matt, can I just chat with you for a second?
Just give me 2 minutes. I just need to talk to Cherry about the Adelstein case.
2 minutes.
I told you to stay out of it.
What was I supposed to do? The cops were dicking around getting nowhere. I found Museum one night.
What, a medal?
He's a serial killer, Cherry. This is different. 60 dead. Would have been one more if Daredevil hadn't shown up. And he's still out there. So I'm going to need you to reach out to your contacts and find out exactly where all of Muse's victims
are. So you think I'm going to enable you with this shit?
He's going to go into survival mode because he knows he's got limited time. If I can figure out his pattern, I can figure out where he's going to strike next. So do me a favor. Talk to your contacts.
No. If you want to blow up your life again, you go ahead. You're on your own.
You know, there was a time when you were on the force. Moments like this. You called me.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Daredevil Born Again, a Podcastica Marvel TV cast. I'm Jim.
And I'm Kirk. The episode we're going to be discussing is Season 1, Episode 7, Art for Art's Sake, written by Jill Blankenship and directed by David Boyd.
And, of course, we know Boyd from the last episode, Episode 6, and it really makes sense that he directed this episode. I think if I did what we talked about in the last podcast, I watched them back-to-back, and the framing, if you frame it that way or even have made that into one really long episode, I think maybe it would have made both of them better, but they did have the same feel with the same almost format, if you think about it. But Boyd, I think, is a very simple director, and I did like them both better. The interesting part about this is the previous director called Boyd the Bernthal Whisperer, which made me think that he was going to direct episodes with Bernthal actually in it. And he wasn't in either of these episodes, which now makes me think the next two episodes were cut apart as well, even though I heard that they weren't. So I think
this was written by Jill Blankenship, and I think she also wrote episode 3, which was the White Tiger court battle episode, which was really good and talks, you know, I feel like you'll see what what I was impressed with this in this episode was also well done in that episode. So
and she's not,
definitely ties in with her.
Yeah, she's not. She doesn't have a rich history of writing or directing or producing like many of these other people do, which I actually like.
Probably helps.
She was connected to. She was a co-executive producer for Arrow in season 7, and then the executive producer of that show during its last season when they wrapped things up.
Didn't write?
She didn't. She did write a couple of episodes for that, yeah. But she's her writing and producing are all limited to about 5 or 6 things, whereas if you try to run through Boyd's, you know, list of the things that he's done, it's, you know, it goes, you know, back into the 90s and as a cinematographer and a director and a writer. And hers, it seems like she's staying very focused and obviously attached to Marvel things. So people like her. And I think she did a great job in both the episodes that she wrote.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure.
I thought that this was a real standout for me in terms of the interpersonal relationships, character building, dialogue. So I have to
credit. It answered some of the questions that you've had throughout, which I think we've all had, but we'll get into that. So
yeah.
Generally speaking, I think you started talking about how you feel about this episode. We've texted a bit outside of this, and I could tell this is one of your favorite episodes. I will say that this is tied for the least liked episode of the series.
I'm
putting this in, you know, if you look on IMDb, we're talking about 8.1. So this is the low standard, and I want to preface all of this too. I think, you know, we're
8
critical.
Out of 10?
Yeah, yeah. So being
so there have been a bunch of 9s and 10s?
They've all hovered between 8.8, which was the episode. Episode 6 was 8.8. Episode 7 was 8.1. As of the last time I checked, and I haven't checked Rotten Tomatoes yet, but yeah. So according to IMDb, so take that for what it's worth. But that 8.8 is the top, and 8.1 is the bottom. So the series has been hovering in pretty good territory.
Yeah, I'll say, holy cow.
So general thoughts, and maybe zoom on into your first point.
General thoughts, it is, in fact, my favorite episode of the season so far. I definitely enjoyed it from beginning to end. There was nothing, there were no cringe moments for me. There were no uncomfortable dialogues or conversations or cuts. So I thought this was, it just seemed to me like they were getting tighter and tighter in the writing. Most importantly, I felt like this had the best character development of side characters. I think for me, that has been a lacking part of the show. I think we've talked about that. And I understand that the show is focused on the two main protagonists, but and their evolution or de-evolution or, you know, rebirthing or being reborn. But I think that one thing that's clear for me is that Daredevil as a character, as a compelling character, needs to have additional side characters that help bring out, you know, your concern for him, for your their connection to him, so that you care about them, so that there's a price to be paid if someone, you know, like Foggy. I mean, the reason Foggy's death was so powerful, even though for any new watcher it probably wasn't very powerful at all, but if you'd watched the series at all, you knew, you know, how important Foggy was. So I felt that the season was lacking that a little bit. I felt this episode's really changed that dramatically for me. I liked it a lot. I do think you and I talked separately after we got done recording the last two episodes, is that they should have split instead of 5-6 together. It should have been 6-7. I mean, 5 could have so easily been a standalone episode, being the bank heist.
Sure.
And then 6 and 7 being kind of the Muse,
the Muse arc.
Yeah, the Muse arc, exactly. And it would have been more powerful, I think. And especially if you'd seen them together, it would have been like a one long episode. And
having watched these three, though, I think the producers, probably Scarpadone, and again, if that's not how you pronounce his name, you know, sorry. I think that probably the biggest concern that they had as second showrunners was that one-off episode being almost impossible to do anything with because it was a secondary story where we sort of got the teeter-totter with Matt kind of shifting from the lawyer to Daredevil. They really couldn't do anything with that episode. So as a standalone, I'm sure they were worried about it. So they tried to tether it to, I think, well, and if you look at the big critical hits that this show has taken. And when I say it plural, there really hasn't been many, but that episode was the one that caught that social media fervor of what are we doing with it? Why? So they were right to an extent. I think people that know the comic books or read comic books or are intertwined with this character, or intertwined with the Netflix series specifically too, were able to look at that episode as a standalone and appreciate it for that. Where I think a lot of people were, if you look at the timing of it, you add an extra episode at the beginning where you do get a little bit of the suit, and then you have this long drawn out process where you don't have the suit, and then you have this episode where he's basically not even attached to the rest of the series.
You mean five.
Speaking of five. So I think it was the showrunner and the executive producers being careful with that one singular episode, not knowing what to do with it. So I think they tethered it to this. And well, I think it was a mistake.
I think they were concerned that they've made everybody wait until episode 6 to get more Daredevil.
Right.
And they just felt like they needed to satisfy that demand, or they were worried and felt they should probably try and satisfy that demand by bringing it, connecting it to episode 6. But
sure.
But I think that was probably made, that wasn't made based on the viewership as they were watching it. I don't think. I think that was probably made before.
They did alter the schedule after the first or second episode and blended those two together. And we speculated that they did it to have it finish prior to.
Andor, which
may have been, to your point, which may have been something that they were going to do, and maybe they had that schedule.
Yeah, but to the other point was, is that 6 and 7 would have worked to better, and they would have gotten the same effect in terms of the schedule.
So
they chose to do it this way because I think they felt like people were going to have to watch Matt be Daredevil again without the suit, and they knew that was, you know, they were pushing the limits on that.
Having watched it now as a singular to a double episode, I think it's great. Like, these two episodes are this one, certainly, depending on where you're at with it, either picks up episode 6 or 6 picks up episode 7, I think brings it to a very solid, like, arc, as we mentioned.
So jumping into my first point, as I mentioned, you know, because the relationships and the character connections, I thought were standouts for me. Cherry and Matt arguing over his getting back into the suit was great. I thought, you know, Cherry clearly cares about him like Foggy did, and he doesn't want to stand by and let Matt, you know, fall off the wagon, essentially.
Sure.
And the intensity of that exchange, it was heartfelt, and it helps us viewers also now care about Cherry and their relationship, because we know how much he cares about Matt. And I felt like that was really, really important. And then, you know, in turn, also McDuffie and Cherry then have a confrontation as a result of that Cherry-Matt confrontation. And, you know, and she's stepping up saying, hey, what's going on with Matt? And he's like, I love that he says, he's on my shit list right now. You don't want to ask me about him. That was great. But again, you know, she wants to be let in to the secret world. She wants to know what's going on. She cares about them. She cares about the firm and wants to help. And that, you know, again, puts her, for me, in a light that's much more positive and connected to Matt and helps his character for me.
Sure. It makes her less of a flat. She's been a flat character throughout this.
Yeah.
You can tell that the actress is putting in great work. There's probably been stuff that's been cut out. And this, she got a chance to breathe with multiple characters in this episode for the first time. And it felt great. Yeah.
Yep. And then the Heather Matt relationship, you know, they actually connect in this episode. You know, it felt kind of superficial up until this point. You know, the opening shower scene really sets the stage, their passion together. I'm going to say more about that scene, but
yeah,
just touching on that. Mm-hmm. Then later, when she's worried about his bruises, you know, she has genuine concern for him and is, you know, reaching out to him. And it makes us care about that character more. And it was crucial that we started to care more about her because of this story arc.
It gave us some depth, and it also gave us fear for the future, because for the first time, we were given a reason to worry about how the hell Matt is going to explain this once again, about how he's got all these bruises with some ludicrousness of him falling when I'm certain that someone.
Yeah, but it was great because she doesn't buy it. I mean, she's a professional. She knows. Well, she knows he's holding back, and she confronts him with him. She's like, "Look, you know, you've been holding back so much trauma."
Yeah. Just the fear, though, going forward of where this is going to go, especially now. We'll get to that later, but yeah, there's some depth there for sure.
We get some great scenes also away from the two main characters to build surrounding characters. You know, like the Gandolfini BB scene, which I know you and I talked earlier about.
Yeah.
I know you didn't care for it too much, but to me, you know, it helped flesh that out. You know, he's becoming an asshole. He's becoming a little Fisk. And more importantly, you know, BB is realizing, you know, she's in over her head a little bit and realizing she'll have to make a decision like her uncle did.
Sure.
You know, is she going to tell the truth and be a journalist, or is, you know, she going to buckle under the fear? so that, to me, that just helps the story overall. Of course, then we've got Fisk talking with Buck. You know, Buck has been kind of this like ghost in the story, you know, and he just kind of pops up. He's doing little dirty work. He didn't seem very important at all. Well, after that discussion where Fisk is sitting by the window, you know, we get so much more about how tight a relationship these guys have, how important Buck is to him. You know, he alludes to his previous career, you know, and I think just fleshes out again Fisk more, because you know, well, now we know this is a very important relationship to him. And I know you're going to talk some more about Buck, so I won't go much more into that.
Well, I just it's been frustrating for me with regards to Buck, just simply because there's a comic book relationship which we'll talk about later, but this actor who has been in, you know, he was in Carnival Row, a fantastic character there, and he's just been again much like Kirsten McDuffie, just this character in the background, to the point where we've had discussions about his true allegiances. Was it to Vanessa? Was it to
episode seven?
Yeah,
all of these characters should be so much richer. Correct. I mean, think about the original series on Netflix.
Yep.
I mean, Karen and Foggy and all these people were so fleshed out by that point. You know what I mean?
Well, to the point, Wesley was as main a character in season one as any other character.
Oh, absolutely.
To the point where,
in fact, I found him a little scarier.
Yeah. Well, because he's the guy who can take Fisk's, you know, kingpin and bring it into the light and sound sane.
Clearly Fisk needs, you know, kind of like we were talking about last week, about the episode last week where he goes and talks to the police himself and makes this rah-rah, you know, go team motivating speech, which is so out of character, in my opinion. You know, he's a manipulator, not a motivator. And because he didn't have anybody like Wesley, but he does. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's what Buck is. And until episode seven and these scenes with him, I just didn't feel that connection. Now I do.
And to your point again last week, Kingpin, and I'm just going to call him that now because it seems like we've entered that phase, although we still haven't gotten the white suit, but we'll come back to that. He has an interaction with the police, the anti-vigilante task force, which is definitively better because of the underlying threat of what he says to Cole North near the end of the episode, where he tells him he's taking credit for this and not Daredevil, even though North was pointing out that it wasn't them that did it. People were falling into their roles and we were getting depth. Like this Cole North character, again, there should be more depth there. We still haven't really got anything with him, but we're starting to.
He's a big character in the books.
Sure, sure. And he's being played right now like he's being forced to make choices. And I feel like in the books, he never really showed that fear. He was just gung-ho, this is who I am. So there's been some choices, I think, that were made in the prior six that the prior six with the original showrunners that are now being re-vetted out better. And this is the episode where I think we're starting to see that kind of launch forward. I'm excited because the new showrunner and the new directors who are taking essentially over full on after they did episode one, they're doing the next two. It definitely seems like they're trying to launch forward with this episode. So definitely positive there.
In the books, I don't ever recall there being... There was Vanessa, and her connection with him was really tight and important and influential. Yeah. But I don't remember there being a Wesley or a Buck type of character.
Wesley was there. Yeah.
Wesley was there. Okay.
Yeah. But Wesley's demise in the comics didn't match Wesley's demise in the show. That's what made me very sad. But Kingpin has in the comic books relied on a variety of different people throughout them. And we've seen them in and out, but that's why I think with a character like Daniel Blake, who to my knowledge is not in the comics, I think that we're getting a lot of these past characters are getting maybe even a new shine. And I think the original showrunners and Daredevil Born Again had a lot of great ideas that weren't vetted out. And it seems like the new people that came in are doing a nice job of piecing it all together and giving weight to it. Unfortunately, I don't think they had enough to be able to do it in the prior six. And I just want to, again, preface, I think that you and I probably share this thought that, you know, it's almost like an 8.1. We're still talking about a show that we love. It's just there are holes in it that are evident, and it's hard to tell because they've done such a masterful job of sewing it together. it's hard to tell where the holes are from, if it was just because of the first six or if it,
it's more kind of like reasons. You feel the holes, you can't identify them.
sure. Well, my point was relationships as well. And I literally wrote all of these down. Matt and Heather, Matt and Cherry, Buck and Kingpin, and just a prop to Artie Frushon, who is playing the Buck character. You can tell that there's going to be more to come with this character. At least they're better. Right. Matt and Angela, we get a brief little connection to sort of give the problem you had in the last episode a little more weight, where you can see that his conversations with her and his connections with her. He was the one who was there waiting with her with his mom. Right. I thought that was a nice little touch. Vanessa and Luca, again, going back to the first episode and going back to the five families where we got to see Buck interacting. We had, of course, Vanessa and Fisk, which I still think is going to be interesting. I know we're going to talk more about that later. I think it's a lot more complicated, although I do think it's heading to an ending of togetherness, but we'll get to that in a second. The Heather and Bastion Cooper relationship, which I actually is one of my points, so we'll come back to this one, which I found in isolation interesting and intriguing, but found in the overall arc a little irritating. We'll get to that. We do get kind of an interesting interaction with detectives in this. Angie Kim has an interaction with Kingpin. Well, we'll call him Wilson Fisk for this because it seemed
which was, again, much better written, much better directed than what we saw in episode five.
Yes.
In my opinion, you know,
well,
her confusion at Fisk and his approach. It just read very real to me.
Yeah. Well, it lends how Fisk is handling the police a little better, right. I think, than in the past. Cherry and Kirsten, Kingpin and Heather, even though they don't have any scenes together per se in this episode, he cares about the fact that he perks up when, you know, she's mentioned as a target, which is, again, a fun little connection for Murdoch, Daredevil, Kingpin, Wilson Fisk, although they could have played that better, but that's for another day. And then I mentioned Kingpin and Cole North just as part of this. And then the BB and Daniel interaction, which... I feel like, you know, he's sitting there playing with his stupid ring, and I know it's based off a comic, but it's almost like they're trying to, and this is probably the point. You pick Michael Gandolfini, and obviously you feel remnants of his father, you know, playing an infamous mobster, and we have a scene at the end of this that's very similar perhaps to the end scene of The Sopranos. Spoilers! But
actually, you're right.
I feel like I don't know. This is one of those episodes.
They should have gone to black and then not let us know what happened until the next episode.
With a Journey song maybe. But I don't want to spend too much time with the BB and Daniel relationship.
No, I get it, man. I get it. I think. What I feel, and I think is echoing what your issues are here, is that it's a perfect example of the lack of character development and relationship development that's been going on, at least throughout the whole show, in my opinion, with side characters. And that if this relationship had been touched on more frequently, instead of there's the first time and then there's the burn, where, you know, he drunkenly, you know, he's trying to hang out with her. He's obviously trying to, you know, show off or whatever. So then he gets burned on that. But then there's this. So it's just kind of like a little too fast for this to have meaning to it.
Which, like, why are they friends? Were they friends prior to this? Like, there's none of that's there.
Right.
And
they
problem.
They try to imply that with that rush kind of, they're out partying scene. You know what I mean?
Sure. Like that, but it seems like they've been friends, right? I don't think it's.
You have to kind of read into it, and that sucks. Show us,
right?
You
know what I mean? Well, and there are things that you know, as a viewer, you can sort of make your own thoughts about, but you've got to give us a platform to stand on, which they haven't done until this episode. And if you think about all the relationships that I just ran through, the thing I didn't like about this episode and these relationships, yes, it was better. It gave us more foundation. It is episode 7. Yeah. We have 2 more episodes in season 1, and
I think that's exactly why this, the BB scene is, and Gandolfini still, even though it was great to get something with them, it's weak because there just is nothing to hang your hat on there.
Yeah.
There's no concern or feeling of like betrayal by him being like that to her.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Sure. Well, and you go back to us getting the depth with Heather and Charlie Cox, and Heather and I'm sorry, right. Matt Murdock. And
right.
That scene was amazing because two actors made it amazing.
Right.
But after, you know, because when she said that she loved him, and I, you know, you could hear her heartbeat kind of underlying there. So he knew that she was telling the truth. And then he says it back to her. I had that doubt. Like, was he really going to say it? And it gave it weight because they acted really well. Right. But then it was like, so we basically have skipped their whole entire relationship. We saw day one.
Well, they had had dinner.
And now they live together.
Yeah, I mean, rushed big time.
So I think
think about the relationship with Karen and how that evolved over the whole season.
Okay, so when she was talking, my favorite part of that scene was the trauma quote, but also she's talking to him and she says, look, Heather, you realize I used to have this whole other life and it was a lot different than this. And I was like, oh, no. And then she says, at your old firm with your old friends. And she, unlike John Bernthal and Punisher, she very quickly says, Foggy, and there's this little pause.
Right.
And then she goes, Karen. And I was like, ooh, it feels like there should be something there that we don't know. And I will say that again, Charlie Cox, fabulous in every scene, but the actor portraying Heather, I'm pissed for her.
She's doing a good job.
Every scene in this episode that she was in, she added so much weight, a lot with her facials, obviously the way she handled things, how she handled Bastion/Muse in her office, which we'll talk about again. But I when she said to Matt in the scene, this is what makes this episode, I think, in my opinion, one of the better episodes. She says things like this. You've been tamping down trauma for so long, you can't even see when it's bubbling up inside of you and threatens to ruin everything good you have, everything good we have. You can see, and I mean, this is the story of Matt. She says it in one sentence, and there's weight to it. And you can kind of see his reaction,
That's also great writing.
Oh, I mean,
she's
pleading fabulous. With him.
She's, yeah. She's, you know, she's saying you're being self-destructive. You know what I mean?
Well, the female characters in this episode are given great writing, and which makes this episode stand out. To your point, Angela Kim has that great scene where she's acting like a police officer to Kingpin, but holds a pensiveness. Like, this is a guy that I was just trying to chase down 5 years ago or seven years ago, however long ago it was.
Well, and also how personal he's getting involved in police work. It's like he's the mayor. What the hell is he doing? why is he, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So I, you know, the relationships part of this was great. I specifically like the Heather Glenn part of it, although I want more there. And of course, now with what's happened in this episode, we're probably going to get some more. Where is this going to go? But again, with only two episodes left and an arc that ended that we just read an article that was going to carry on into season two, which may or may not, I don't know. I there was lots I loved about it. And there were just some gaps in the relationships based on everything that we've talked about in prior podcasts that just stood out to me. So I'm going to add my point one there with the relationships, because finally now earn my trust back. Keep giving me some more before we get to the end of episode 9. All right. Point two, let's head down point.
Point two, very simple. That opening shower with Matt
being,
I thought it was just perfect. He's, you know, so metaphorically being baptized.
Yes.
Born again.
Well, and how they interjected Angela's dream with a scene of Matt as Daredevil, and then it flashes right to him throwing his head back in the shower.
Right.
Like he was baptizing himself.
Yeah. And like he also that he's been reborn, which is what baptism is, right? And
you know, it's almost like it's the title of the series.
I also like how, without being beating us over the head or being too much religiosity, I don't know if that's the right word, but you know, it brings back Matt's religious connection, and the fact that, you know, which we then get her words about, you know, you've been holding back all this trauma later in that scene. You know, that's kind of also like he's been holding back the devil, you know, who gets out all of his pent up trauma. And then her joining him in that shower, there was no words.
Without questions. Yeah. Words,
just passion.
Yeah.
And it reinforced, you know, how satisfied I think he is once now that he's being himself and how much more comfortable he is in his own skin and with other people and with her, because he's kind of let out this thing that he's been holding back for so long.
Yeah.
He's more at peace. He can be more himself. He can be more passionate. He can, that side of him. I thought it was great.
Yeah. Again, it lends to the weight. It's a blend of things here. I think that, you know, we kind of sent funny memes back and forth to each other throughout the week. And you sent me the one where Matt Murdock's not really blind, showing all the women that he's involved with. And but it lends to this character that throughout both the run in the movies and the run in the comics and the run in the, obviously the series, the two series now, he is a very sexual character who is, I would stop a step short of saying playboy, but he certainly plays to his charms because of his senses. And I think that's always been a big part of the comic.
He's got the riz and he uses it.
So, but the seriousness of that scene, because, you know, you see the blood, and when she started walking in to the bathroom, I'm like, she doesn't know. Well, we don't know this, but we find out by the end, she doesn't know who he is. She doesn't have a reason to. Right. She doesn't know that he's Daredevil. And this, again, this secrets that he has to hold her now back full force, because, you know, Boggy knew, actually the only, you know, their Cherry knows, but obviously Heather doesn't. And you're like, how's he going to explain all the blood on it? But she doesn't ask any questions. When she walks in, they spend the night together, and then when they wake up in the morning, the questions start coming. And
well, it's also there's a non-verbal acknowledgement.
Yeah, of her touching the bruise.
Her touching the bruise, that this guy is still somewhat tortured, that he's in pain, that he's suffering, that he's hurt. And then she says that in the next scene. But show us, don't tell us. And that was great.
Yeah, and it wasn't, what I love about it too, is it wasn't a threat, that how she was talking to him. And it wasn't even quite as a therapist, even though Matt makes a quip about it. It you can tell the way that she's portraying it and the way that Matt is portraying it too, that he doesn't want her to know. She wants to know, but there's a depth there of love. This isn't like, if you're this person, I'm going to leave you. Although she does make a quote at the to Muse that might lend us some trouble down the road, but we'll get there.
Well, she does say, you're destroying this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're undermining this.
Which, but then folds into the I love you. You know what I mean? Like, my point simply being is just, a badly written script, it would have had them, this is who you are. If you're not telling me the truth, this relationship is over.
Right.
But there was a weaving of complexity there where she can't, I mean, she's not yet to the point where she could even comprehend that Matt's Daredevil.
Right.
So she's not there yet, but she knows that there's something going on that he's not telling her about, and she wants to be there. But if he doesn't acknowledge the trauma that he's had, she somewhere down the line won't be a part of his life, which plays out in front of us and in front of her sort of at the end of the episode too. And you know, if we fold into that episode or that the end scene where they're together, where she had just said to Muse that, you know, if you're a coward, if you wear a mask, you know, so I think that, you know, and she's a smart person who realized that someone else is there and realized that it was Daredevil and realized that Daredevil said her name. So we're heading down a path, and then there's this unspoken memory that Kingpin knows who he is, and we have this complex what will he or won't he ever say anything tied together with the last scene of the Netflix series where we have Daredevil
their promise, right?
Yeah, Daredevil saves Vanessa's life and they make their promises to each other, which I suspect at some point are going to come to an end, because I can't imagine that we're not going to at least play a little with people knowing who Daredevil is.
Right.
So anyways, yeah. So my point too is kind of a common theme that we've talked about in numerous episodes. We get a full on description of how thoroughly Kingpin, Wilson Fisk, believes that he is the hero of the story. And it's that scene that you were talking about where Buck, we get to see Buck sort of vetted out a little bit, where Buck and he are having a conversation about Daredevil coming back. And we get to see D'Onofrio just, he gets a little expository here, but he does it in a way that's so amazing. When Buck says, you know, Daredevil cleaning up this mess isn't a bad thing, is it? You know, for the sake of the city. Right. And he says that, for the sake of the city. And then Kingpin says, and the way he says it, he goes, for the sake of the city. And I was like, ooh. We're talking about, and this diatribe that he gives him is so reminiscent of current day politics, you know, and without really diving into that, he says, and if you take into all of the things that Daredevil has quote unquote done to him, which is really actually saving the city, but we're talking about a man who single-handedly destroyed 10 years of business structure, not to mention the fact that he was a mob boss, but I digress. You understand what I'm saying? 10 years, I built that operation. It was totally fail-proof. Fail-proof until he had me unjustly arrested.
Right, as
he
if he's a victim.
He took down my entire business, one that made hardworking people who believe in themselves and my enterprise richer than they ever dreamed of. An entire network of blue-collar millionaires, under that term, blue-collar millionaires, from distributors overseas to port workers here. And he's saying it in a sad voice at that point. I actually wrote sad, but I wrote it for a different reason. But I don't want to connect. Those people, they had grit. He went on a rampage. He tracked down all of my workers. And this comes from, for those of you that have watched Echo, there was a great scene with Daredevil in there, spoilers, where he's he's kind of tearing apart Kingpin's operation, which I love.
Yeah.
He tracked down all my workers, custom facilitators, all of them savagely beating them down. He broke bones, broke spirits without due process, without standing or legal cause.
Without due process.
All because of this twisted, delusional man, this vigilante, because of his righteousness. And I watched that episode, I watched that scene, and I was like, oh my gosh, this guy truly believes it. He truly believes it. But what's amazing about that is that he is slowly sucking in all of these people around him into buying into it as well.
Right.
The police, the anti-vigilantes, Daniel, Buck, obviously, dependent on where Buck comes from. And we'll talk about that in a news piece. But I just, that scene was so powerfully puts how righteous Wilson Fisk believes he is. And now he's the mayor. And it kind of puts him even on another pedestal to try to get rid of the vigilantes or trying to stop him from being
the kingpin of crooks.
Yeah.
Gosh, it touches too much. It touches too much truth for me, Kirk. It touches too much truth. But again, I'm backing out of that and heading towards your third point.
My third point is just a couple of individual little points. I love the editing back and forth between Heather and Muse and Fisk with Detective Kim. I thought it was a great way for us, rather than just seeing Heather and Muse and him slowly, you know, getting more bizarre, it just had a little bit more power with the cuts back and forth with Fisk and Kim discussing this guy's degeneracy and mental illness and history of crime. And
they found a way to give us expository without it feeling like expository, right? Because of how they blended it together.
I mean, the only downside is it's like she's read the damn report. So he's sitting there reading it to her and she's like, motherfucker, I know I read the thing, I put the thing together for you, you know what I mean? It's like, why are you reading it to me, you dumb fuck?
But I love that. I love
But I think that's part of her whole expression, which is,
yeah, great,
you know what I mean?
And part of who he is, because clearly she can't know about it until he knows about it. So,
right.
But this dude doesn't, Daniel knows shit before he does. Right. It's kind of funny when you think about it. Like, Daniel comes to him with all this stuff and he's just a bumbling idiot. Anyways. Okay. Sorry.
I love the muse lying on the canvas like a self-portrait. At the end, but also that is Daredevil art.
Yeah.
Daredevil created that art. Well, him and Heather together, I guess.
Yeah.
But
as an artist, how did you feel about that?
I hope it didn't give you thoughts, because I'm thankful we're doing this on Zoom.
Yeah, amen. First, it's also the first villain in the Daredevil series, whether Netflix or this series, that he fights that has a costume.
Yeah.
If you think about it. And I thought that was pretty cool. We're finally getting Daredevil really in the MCU, you know, and not just like Daredevil in New York City.
Yeah.
Because he's a New York guy. You know what I mean? It's like, I mean, I suppose you could count the Punisher from the Netflix series. You know, he had kind of a costume. But really, this is the first supervillain with a supervillain costume that he fights.
Yeah. Fleshed out costume, too. And I loved, I don't know if his costume was made out of burlap, but I loved that it looked a little like a canvas as well.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. But yeah, I think that's on purpose, I think.
I can't remember in the comics if that was what it was, but the costume was fabulous.
Yeah.
Absolutely wonderful.
Very cool.
Bad guy costume. Yeah, good point.
And, I liked that he does his own self-portrait while he's talking to her with his blood from his nose, but then ends up on the canvas as a self-portrait.
Yeah.
For real. So I thought that was kind of a cool little thing. And then, the fight sequence itself was epic. Obviously, again, we talked about last time about how I was using the baton more, and just loved all of that fight scene. I also loved that they had, and again, you mentioned that the female characters were so much better written in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that Heather fights back, she doesn't just cower.
Yeah.
She goes for the gun at one point. And then of course in the end is the one that takes him down.
Yeah.
Which was beautiful.
Well, I do want to mention too, and I think we talked about this a little bit.
Not the right word.
Yeah. Well,
empowering.
Yes.
How about that?
Yes. Her character, her as an actress, which again sort of scared the director a bit. She much like Charlie Cox, like she didn't want a stunt double to do a lot of the scenes that she was part of. So the first two or three takes of Bastion Muse slamming her into the wall was her, and she wanted to keep doing it and had to be asked not to, because
they didn't want to screw up the filming.
Yeah. So
she gets hurt.
And that's what he actually kind of jokingly said that, but you could tell that, you know, there was some, there was some levity to what he was saying, but the actress's name is Margarita LaViva. And I probably really butchered that, but she's been fabulous in the series.
Yeah. And one thing she's really great at is communicating with her eyes.
Mm.
There was so much facial expression and you know, like she goes from being soft and open and listening,
yeah,
to then you kind of start to see the anxiety start to come in, and then fear come in, and again all nonverbal, and then almost tears when there's this realization, I might die here.
Yeah.
And but then resolve, I'm gonna fight back, I'm not going down without a fight, fuck this, you know what I mean? And really, 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 really well done.
Yeah. And when you take into account her life was clearly at risk, you know, without really diving into the meat of it, because I don't know what Apple Podcasts will like yank down or not, but she had a wound that was clearly life-threatening, and at no point did she give up. And they made a point of showing her fighting back to the point where in the middle, the fight was so amazingly intricate, because you had so many different things going on. This was my fourth point as well. The interaction between first her and Bastion, then to her and Muse, then him, laying out the canvas, Daredevil in the plane of day bursting through the window. So you have then the interaction between the three, but then you have the anti-vigilantes coming and you have Matt paying attention to them. So you have this, and then you in the background, you have this again, to your religiosity part, you have this chorus playing in the background that they built up the tension. And the interplay between all of this, she gets starts to get up and Muse grabs the knife, which leads to one of my favorite scenes in any of the Daredevil seasons when he uses the billycock string to wrap around him and blood squirts out of his chest because the string, he pulls the string taut. The fact that this character, probably the only bit of exposition that frustrated me was the whole Taekwondo bullshit. I'm not even going to dive down that. But what I did like about it was it gave meaning for how well this human could fight against Daredevil. Daredevil has a little bit of Taekwondo experience as well. It made this fight more realistic and very abruptly ended. And I did not see it coming. And I loved that part of it, to where you can see that now Heather's going to have some trauma to work through going forward. So
Yeah, I
I just.
definitely took it to her comments in that final scene at the hospitals that she knows that
Yeah,
he's Daredevil now.
I think he said my name and he was trying to play it off. And
Yeah.
I just,
I think it's
I.
gonna end up with them. I think that's gonna be the breaking part of them. I think
Yeah.
that's my guess, is that
Well,
her
I.
knowledge, her finding out about that will be, but that'll also she'll still also be an important character, I hope.
Yes. Well, I hope so too.
Because
Yeah.
she'll be somebody who knows who he is, that he can go to, he can get support and talk to, and
Well, and remember, she has a relationship both with Vanessa and Wilson Fisk that I would assume is going to continue in some form or fashion. And we haven't talked about the elephant in the room, and I'm by no way calling Karen Page an elephant. But
I thought you were calling me an elephant. I was getting
well,
nervous.
I mean, listen, if you were an artist in the room, I certainly wouldn't be saying that, especially if you were finger painting with blood. But
With my nose blood. Haven't done that in a long time.
I loved the end of this episode. The last 25 minutes sends us down so many different directions. And I think to the new team that put all of this together, to tie it all together this way without it feeling like it didn't fit, because I can only imagine all of the different ways they called together the footage to do the fight scene, to do the scene with Luca sitting in the car, to do the scene with Vanessa, to do the scene with Luca walking up on Kingpin, to do the scene with the police and Kingpin, standing there taking credit for killing Muse, holding up the mask, which I thought was a great little touch. And then we have that ending scene, very reminiscent of any mob movie that you've ever seen, where there's going to be someone whacked in a very popular and real, with a real address, restaurant in Brooklyn. The scene where we have, we see Vanessa sending a text to Luca to go to a restaurant that he's going to be alone. And of course, we see again, you talk about cinematography here. We see Luca walk up through the outside. He looks in through the window and sees Kingpin. There's no way anybody else could be there. And he walks up and he's, as he's pulling out the gun, I'm like, well, something better happen soon or this is going to end in a really big shock. And then we get to see Buck kind of do his thing, and we realize that Buck's just not a suit. There's definitely more to his character, but it does lend to, and I mean, I know that I like complexity, and I like that they. I watched an interview with David Boyd, the director, who talked about the end scene, and I don't believe the end scene was the way it was originally initiated. He was asked what that end scene meant, and he very coyly said the executive producers definitely wanted you to think certain ways at the end of the scene without really giving away whether or not Vanessa set him to kill him or set him to be killed. And they obviously ended without answering that question, although I think we have some differing points here coming up. I thought it was open to interpretation, which of course we'll find out very quickly. with the next episode. But
right.
I like that they ended the scene without giving us black and white. Did she send him to be killed, or did she send him to kill? And
I felt it was black and white, but I know you didn't.
Yeah, well, but that I think is the point. I think I think Vanessa has set up enough in the past, and we've talked about all this, where she wants power, but again, does she want power alone, or does she feel more galvanized to have power with? And
well, does she want power, or does she want her kingpin back?
Yeah, well, it's great,
and the power that comes with that, obviously. But
which Luca points to in this episode, right. Like, this was better with you, and right. You know, and I personally believe that Kingpin and Vanessa as a duo is a market improvement over any other direction they could possibly go, which perhaps, no pun intended, murders any possibility of a setup involving Foggy. But then again, maybe not. Maybe you do things at the beginning that you don't want to do at the end, but you've already done, and maybe that plays a part in the story, who knows. But I loved the dance. Well,
I think we will get an answer on that, because Bullseye's coming back.
Yeah, well, yeah.
I think we'll get an answer on that.
Definitely. And, you know, I'll stop there, because there has been a trailer for episode 8, but I'm not going to talk about that. So
I loved how that final scene in the restaurant just reminded me so much of The Godfather.
Mm.
And when Michael Corleone says
Michael becomes Michael.
Right. And he goes to the restaurant, which is, I thought maybe it was in Brooklyn, but I just looked it up. It was in the Bronx. but they didn't go that quite that far in terms of echoing that. But that's how it felt to me. And then the restaurant being bought out, of course, reminds me of the scene when he first goes on the date with Vanessa and he buys out the whole restaurant. It's just the two of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the Russians come in, and that sets up probably the most graphic takedown of somebody. on TV, but I loved all of that. I loved the callback to The Sopranos, the idea of the hit and all that stuff. Yeah. And then, you know, the fact that, you know, when Buck steps out and shoots him, how he just says, "Thank you, Buck."
it was
perfect. You know,
well, and just questioning,
never misses a beat eating.
No, well, and when you have a former mob boss who's a mayor sitting in an Italian restaurant at the end of an episode in which we still haven't seen the man in the white suit, it does lend credence to the fact that perhaps now Wilson Fisk can be Kingpin with his wife, as opposed
to
against him.
As back as Daredevil is. And I think that's,
we don't have a suit yet though. No, man. Come
that's
on.
True. That's true.
Come on. We got a suit up. He's walked by that white suit. He's walked by that white suit. Well, and it didn't fit until now. So maybe he had to eat that calamari or whatever the hell he was eating. That was the last. Matt Murdock goes and does a little work with his billy clubs, and Kingpin goes to an Italian restaurant and eats it out. All right. Do you have any notes?
No, that's it.
I don't.
Great episode. Great episode.
I do want to say this. I apologize. Kingpin's current chief of staff, who was not even in this episode, but I was already, I got her name last week, since I never know her name. Remember this forever, Kirk, because I'm sure she's a major player throughout the next two seasons. Sheila Rivera. I apologize for not knowing your name, even though you, for some reason, weren't in this episode at all. So maybe you're dead. I don't know. All right.
Who is she?
Let us. She's his chief of staff, the one.
Oh,
who,
yeah. Oh yeah. Okay. I didn't know where you were going. I got it. Yes.
Well,
getting her name.
I don't know.
What's the last name?
Rivera.
Rivera.
Yeah. Who's she? Is probably, well, I'm not gonna be mean. All right. We're gonna take a break. There's more to come. We got some news. So stay with us.
Welcome back to Hell's Kitchen Confidential. We got a little bit of Daredevil, actually quite a bit of Daredevil news, thanks to an interview that a brand new interview that Vincent D'Onofrio did with a YouTube interviewer named Josh Horowitz. He spilled a ton of goodies, including one that I don't think anybody has talked about whatsoever, although we talk about this happening to lots of other characters, the Incredible Hulk being one of them. But Wilson Fisk, many people have been expecting him to show up maybe in a Spider-Man movie specifically, because Kingpin becomes, you know, quite the antagonist to Spider-Man throughout several different runs. But Wilson, D'Onofrio let us know that as of now, Wilson Fisk cannot be used in any of the MCU movies. And I'm just going to read a few quotes from the article. He was asked, you know, will we see Wilson Fisk in one of the new phases, especially with the Avengers movies coming up and perhaps Brand New Day that was just announced. And D'Onofrio said, "The only thing I know is not positive," D'Onofrio explained to Josh Horowitz on the podcast Happy, Sad, Confused recently. "It's a very hard thing to do for Marvel to use my character. It's a very hard thing to do because of ownership and stuff. I'm only usable for television shows, not even a one-off Wilson Fisk movie. It's all cut up in rights and stuff. I don't know when that would work out or if it ever would work out at all." And, you know, you can intertwine this into two different categories, because you had the initial Daredevil use of Wilson Fisk in the original movie in 2003, which I believe was a Sony.
And then obviously Sony has the rights to all of the Spider-Man parts, and I believe that Wilson Fisk may be lumped in with that. So as of right now,
well, Fisk, the Kingpin is a Spider-Man villain first. And then became a prominent Daredevil villain and is pretty much associated almost exclusively with DD. But he really is a Spider-Man character. So I'm not surprised to hear that, because they got like something like 900 characters when they did that deal. But I would argue, I would guess that it would be relatively easy to get him into one of the Sony Spider-Man movies, to bring him into Spider-Man movies, although he seems to rule that out in this article. But I don't see why that, I mean, they may have to pay Sony, but, and Sony may be resisting it because they, you know, have plans to use him some other way, but
sure.
But I think they could get him in.
Yeah. Well, they used him in the last, Miles Morales.
Yeah, but that's animated.
Yeah, well, but it's
animated,
but it's
is different. All the
but that's still part of that. But that's still part of that universe. That's
But they can do, Marvel can do that. That was Sony anyway. That was Sony.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So that's my point. Like so to your
but
point.
But it's an alternate universe. That's not.
But
the
it is one that the producers of all the movies have said in many ways is interconnected, though. The characters,
yeah, it's interconnected. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Multiverse is interconnected. Yeah.
So I am super intrigued by all of it, because, you know, they used him for the Netflix show. It's never been brought up before. Obviously, we've talked about him possibly being in movies before, not us, but everyone. Like, when's D'Onofrio going to show up? And it's been a little bit of a head scratcher that he hasn't. This makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Also, though, I will say this. D'Onofrio in the past has been coy. And if there's one thing I know about him, is he, even if Sony let him be in a movie that wasn't Sony related, this would be a great story to tell. I mean, it's true, but it also might not be. So I'm going to just listen to it with a grain of salt and see where we go with it. It would be such a rich character to add to the MCU in one way or another. Preferably with Spider-Man, but we shall see.
So in that same interview, Vincent was discussing, let out some information about some discussions with Kevin Feige and his role in the show overall. And it was pretty interesting. Between Charlie and I, yes, it was a collective idea, he said, of the overhaul. You know, I have to say, the initial writers, they had a great idea. The idea was a good idea. Unfortunately, I don't think it would have had a chance, because we were disconnecting from the original show. So I guess he's talking about how they had to kind of redo, Kevin had to step in and kind of redo the whole thing a little bit.
How crazy is it, though, that the two actors really were the ones that spearheaded
the
change, Because clearly Feige wasn't part of it at all prior to this. Well, I mean, when I say not part of it at all, I say they sort of had to bring him back into it, which is
Well,
interesting.
they stepped up and kind of brought it to Kevin's attention, you know, that it just wasn't working.
I love that.
Charlie and I couldn't understand, he says, how we were supposed to portray these characters that everybody loves within the environment that we were putting us in. He continued, so we kept on bumping against that whole time. Luckily enough, we have a boss named Kevin Feige.
Yeah, it's crazy.
He listens to everything, he watches everything, and you can talk to him like you can anybody on the crew. He's a very straight up dude. He's got to be, I would say, as far as his position, completely unique. He says that this is a pretty big compliment. 40 years
Yeah.
of acting, he's completely unique to me. In the context of the position that he's in, he listened very carefully and he did the due diligence to get to the bottom of it, and it ended up the way it ended up. The actor added, "We were actively communicating, Charlie and I, and we needed to talk to the initial writers constantly every day. We felt like their idea was amazing, but that we were going to eventually fail if we didn't write the ship a bit." So that was pretty cool. While Corman and
Yeah.
Ord did do some good work on the series, the divisive bottle episode, the fifth chapter with Interest, was the only one untouched by the new creative team. You had mentioned that last week.
Yeah.
If it was indicative of what the series would have looked like as a whole, then yes, we can safely assume that Daredevil Born Again was in trouble.
That is definitely that. Just so we're clear, that's not D'Onofrio speaking. That's the writer.
Right.
I hate that there are people that don't see how important episodes like episode five can be. And again, coming from somebody who said as many F words about it before I watched it, it is really growing on me to the point. I mean, if like I said last week, if it's the worst episode of the season, then I'm good. Like it definitely has an 8.5 feel to me. So I do think that the new showrunners have done just such a great job of piecing it together that you can leave that episode alone and it fits perfectly well. So
Yeah, I think
I
the
hate.
important the takeaway for me though here is that and why I think the MCU has been so successful is that you've got someone at the top, Kevin Feige, who listens to the creatives, who trusts in the creative process and supports it, is
Yes.
not it's not an ego trip. It's not a I know what's best type of deal. For instance, he knew that that series was the standout of the Netflix Marvel shows, that it was super popular, super successful. So when the people who were the backbone of that are saying to him, the ship is not going in the right direction, you got to have faith in that. You got to trust in that. You know, you can't let your ego be like, well, these are the people I put in charge to write it and direct it and produce it or whatever, and I trust them. So, you know, get lost. You're the actors. Do what you're told. Read the script. Know what I mean?
Well, especially when you take it, when you put it in perspective and you realize that, he didn't work with D'Onofrio and Cox in the Netflix series. The people that he hired to run this new show are the people that he let go because the actors didn't see the direction of their characters. And I think you can handle this as the mastermind behind the MCU. You can handle this in one of two ways. We've seen it play out and over time, actors can come and talk and be labeled as miscreants and troublemakers. And he didn't do that. He listened to these two actors who quite honestly portrayed an intense care, not only for their character, but for the audience. He listened to them. And then what I loved about the statement is, he didn't just listen to them and then go, everybody's fired. He listened to them and then he pointed out the due diligence that Feige put into kind of researching what was going on and perhaps looking at some of the things that had already been shot and realizing that the heart of the show is what was missing. And the heart of the show is what we've already seen. So he gave it that heart with episode one and hopefully we close with a lot more heart. And that article ends with, the kind of hopeful news that we get to see the full fruition of this new team in season two, which I'm very much looking forward to because I think they did a great job putting together season one. The final short little piece of news was Ayelet Zer, the actress who portrays Vanessa. And if her name is nothing like what I just said, again, I gave myself all the fun names.
I had to look at it myself and say, how would I pronounce that?
They did an interview asking her specifically about that end scene, whether or not she tried to kill the kingpin versus killing Luca. And she said, you know, she was able to share thoughts on Vanessa's mindset, touching on the sense of loyalty and trust between the characters, which lends me to believe that her loyalty and trust is always going to be with Wilson Fisk. But she says, and I quote, the whole show for them, and I assume she's talking about Fisk and Vanessa, is about loyalty and trust. So let's see where it's going, she said. I think from her perspective, she sees the same person in Wilson Fisk, really. She sees who he is fully. She doesn't see the bad side of him or the good side of him. I think she sees him in a full sense. And I feel like maybe he does the same for her. Maybe. He comes to the set season in a different, she says that, we are different people, but while they are being different, their emotions are the same, I think. And all of her little hesitations there, the I thinks and the maybes and the, is her maybe thinking she's going too far? But I think that quote lends to what you were thinking in that end scene, that she definitively just said, hey, Wilson, I'm sending this guy to you, take care of it.
Right. Well, all right. I mean, what she's looking at is if she condones that, she's condoning basically an all-out war between the crews. There's, you know, none of the other crews have said sworn loyalty to her like he did. Mm-hmm. So you don't know how they're going to react. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And also, if he's willing to turn on Kingpin, he's willing to turn on her.
Sure.
So, you know, he's a threat. Yeah. It makes no sense to support that.
Yeah.
And he mistakes her feelings as being in concert with his, that things were better when she was in charge.
Yes.
And she clearly agrees that from a business point of view, yes. But she wasn't satisfied. She wasn't whole. Right. She wasn't happy necessarily. She did it the best way she could, and that worked out well for everybody from a financial business point of view. But from a power point of view, Kingpin's obviously got more power,
well,
more influence. So
I think that changing actresses back to the original perhaps made the build up to where we're at even a little bit different. Obviously, there's a whole crew of people who've watched this, the first three on Netflix, that have a feeling about the relationship between the two, and maybe bringing in a new actress would have allowed them to take a different course of action. Hmm. I think that together or apart, I think that what happens earlier in the season, you can still have a little bit of fun with that, because there clearly was a point where they were apart and she maybe made decisions.
She didn't know whether he was going to come around.
Sure.
She didn't know that. Right. So I don't think this undermines your theory at all.
Yeah. I think that it actually adds complexity to it in the same way, again, to parallel things that Heather and Matt have going for them, where this him being Daredevil versus Fisk being Kingpin, you know, the irony of them getting closer, Vanessa and Wilson, while Heather and Matt are clearly going to start splitting apart, while one is becoming a hero and one is becoming a villain, is just a fun. It's always been the fun part of these two characters in the comics and in the series as well. So I don't want to spend too much time with this, because we do have a little bit of comic book news.
No, I think it's great. I think it's a great mirroring. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She's estranged from Fisk when he's not Kingpin.
Right. Yeah. So
and Matt is tight with Heather when she thinks he's just Matt. And now the reverse is happening on both sides. Yeah.
So
awesome.
Yeah. Where we can go with all these relationships, which again is now rebuilding a core for this new series, is going to be a lot of fun. All right. We are going to end there. We've got a little bit of comic book news before we wrap things up. We'll be back in a second. All All right, so I've got one really quick comic book connection here, and I know this is one of your points, so pipe in, Kirk, whenever you want to. But Buck is a character of curiosity for me. He is a part of the MCU. He's been a part of Daredevil for a long time. And not only Daredevil, but we'll get into kind of where he ends up before coming back to Daredevil in the comics. But, you know, first and foremost, Buck wasn't a British character. He was an American agent named Bullet, who is pulled in by Kingpin to more or less do his bidding throughout. And he has a very interesting relationship with Daredevil that, to start with, and then over the course of 40 years of being in the comic books, he becomes a symbiote, which I actually want you to talk about because I don't know about that rip at all, although it's I'll add a show link that you can, or yeah, he had a, well, what happened was, and I read one comic book, and actually he was, his dogs had the symbiote in it, and I believe Carnage makes a call out to them, and they leave the dog and they go into him, and he becomes a symbiote for a while. Before he ends up back as Bullet and actually befriends Daredevil, actually saves him at one point in the comic. But I think the interesting arc to this is that he was a part of the U.S. government before, that Wilson Fisk used as part of his underworld ties, and so he was a villain throughout. Where it looks like this character has a little more. This character has a little more complexity to it. So he does note that when I brought you from this other world, and we don't know what that other world is, although we definitely know that it's not some straight-laced suit sort of world. So I'll be curious to see what this Buck, what his past, hopefully we get to vet out his past, because I'm intrigued. I'm interested to find out.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting too, that he's had, some relationship with the character Bullseye as well.
Yeah. Comics. Yes. And also Typhoid Mary too. Uh-huh. So there are lots of little connections to characters that we've seen with some of the other Defenders. So
he also I think became a hero.
Yes. Right? Well, so
because I got a note here that he ends up working with Hank Pym, has a group called the Lethal Legion. Team.
Oh yeah, the anti-ultra lethal legion. Well, that's it. That rolls right off.
That had to be the 90s. That sounds like that sounds like Image people writing.
I believe that's in the 2020s, to be honest.
Oh my gosh.
But the one point at the end of this, he does befriend Daredevil because Daredevil protects his son, helps protect his son.
Right.
Who's involved in all of this. So there is an interesting arc for Buck in the comics that may or may not relate to who we get to see in however long this Born Again series goes. We know we've got two seasons of it. So
right.
will he be?
Yeah. Will he move? Will he slide one way or the other?
Yeah. It's so, but the actor's great. His interviews, if you ever get to see him, there's a red carpet interview of him where he's just enthralled with playing this character and being part of the MCU, and earnestness of that I love about the characters they get. The characters they get for the show, there's a gratefulness to being part of this cast that I think enhances everybody's role. So, all right, we're going to end that there. And I guess we're heading towards the end of the show.
I just wanted to point out that we had to talk just a second, Avengers Doomsday cast announcement.
Oh gosh, we've never talked about that.
No, we didn't talk about that. So that was pretty cool. And I think, you know, there was some social media reaction was negative, but man, that was the most brilliant thing they've done recently. I mean, you know, Marvel just really had everybody's attention for the whole day. I mean, there was nothing but live streams going on TikTok and everything else all day long. And I think it was a fantastic way to do this. I don't think they'll repeat it, but I think it was a brilliant masterstroke of marketing that just owned the day.
Oh, and the fact that they showed us all of those chairs focuses everybody's attention on all the names on the backs of those chairs, knowing full well the way Marvel does things, that there are certainly people that are going to be in this movie that they haven't mentioned yet or will
Well,
mention it until the movie comes out.
at CinemaCon, which was this weekend, Kevin Feige spoke and clarified that there are more casts to be announced. And we knew that because we knew that a number of the original six Avengers were already signed on to come back, but that they weren't in the chairs. So, and then I guess there's been a number of actors too that are still in negotiations who said, you know, they're planning on being in it or whatever, but they're not, it's not official yet. Like Halle Berry playing Storm. So they just haven't signed set yet, so they can't put them in that kind of thing. So and I think they don't want to give away the story too much, so they don't want to tell too much about who's going to be there.
The addition of the Fantastic Four, just in the overarching part of the MCU, sort of shifted everyone away from the X-Men discussion. So having Patrick Stewart and having Kelsey Grammer and these older X-Men, no mention of Wolverine, no mention of
Deadpool.
the Deadpool, no mention of the first class of X-Men, just lends me to think we're going to get to see them at some point, and either they haven't negotiated with them yet, or they're not going to be in this specific movie.
Well,
So,
yeah, I mean, you've got two movies back to back that are based on stories that are so large and so sweeping and involve the entire MCU in the books.
Well, and a rich history too, where you can pull from an 80s version and you can pull from a teens version, because I wasn't familiar with the one that you talked about last week. The current version where Doom sort of
Secret
has that,
Wars?
yeah, well,
Or of the
the Secret Wars,
time runs out storyline.
the Time Runs Out storyline. Yeah,
Which is a bit, it's a bit chaotic. I've got all the trades recently and reread them, and it's a bit all over the place, but it does, I mean, it does end up boiling down to basically a consistent story, but I don't want to, you know, get into it too much, but I think it feeds into Doomsday really well. In other words, they've set, and the thing that's great too is they've set things up like in Marvel's the end credits. Did you see that movie, the Marvels? The end extra credit scene where Photon ends up going through to the X-Men universe. It just, and those are the X-Men that are in this Doomsday. So there's in the storyline of time's running out, you've
We
got
see
these,
Kelsey Grammer in that, correct?
the last two universes are the MCU. Well, in this, the MCU in the comic book, it's 616, but and this other universe, and they're going to collide, and that'll be it for the whole, the rest of the, all the other universes are gone. And I think that's basically what the story is going to be. You know, you're going to have the X-Men universe basically getting ready to have an incursion, which is what they call it in the MCU, with the MCU universe. And so initially you'll have these two universes fighting with each other, and then realizing that, you know, the bigger issue is Doom, who's kind of orchestrating everything.
Well, I am just intrigued with who Christopher Evans is going to be.
Never heard him called Christopher before.
I listen. They've earned this place in my heart.
There you go.
But
I think there's lots of speculation on that. My guess is he'll just be a Captain America from that universe, from that X-Men universe.
You don't
Everyone's
think
thinking
he'll be
he's going
the
to be, do you think he's going to be evil, that he's going to be the Hydra Cap? And I mean, maybe, but I don't think so. I think you're just going to have two universes of heroes, and each one thinks they're fighting to save their universe, and
I
that's
would be
what causes.
happy. I would be happy and content if he was the older version that we see at the funeral. Like I'd be happy as him in a mentor role. Like I
Yeah,
just
that'd be
I'm
cool.
happy he's going to be in it. I think adding the potential that he could be a Johnny Storm somewhere, or even a Johnny Storm. We get a Johnny Storm version of him, and
Well, there
then
might be a Fantastic Four in that universe.
Right. So,
I don't think,
I mean,
I think I wouldn't say it's clear, but to me, it seems pretty obvious that the Fantastic Four is coming from another universe,
right,
a third universe that is actually gets destroyed.
Yes.
And through this process and they escape to the MCU. So they own then. So then they're like, okay, this is our new universe. So we're going to definitely protect this one. But that doesn't mean there isn't a Fantastic Four and a Reed Richards and a Johnny Storm and all that from the other universe. Too.
Well, you know,
be pretty cool.
Yeah. So it's just, they've kind of been flubbing on and off with this multiverse since they've started it up for a lot of reasons they can control and some that they can't. But
yeah,
I think
a lot that they couldn't control.
Yeah, I mean,
pandemic, you couldn't control. The writer's strike, you couldn't control.
And the actor who portrayed Kang, you can't control.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
the Marvel news that's going to be seeping out over the course of the next 2 or 3 months prior to this Fantastic Four movie and then after, because I think if you watch the preview for the Fantastic Four, you get a glimpse of a very tall being.
Yeah.
Walking into
frame at what looks like the Fantastic Four world, which
does his name rhyme with Malaptus?
Perhaps.
which would lend itself to
it's a very galactic-like figure,
which I can't wait to see. I cannot wait to see.
I can't either. I can't. So, finally, gonna get it right. The big question there has always been, you know, is that character going to consume planets or consume universes?
Right.
And if he's consuming universes, then he kind of might be the one single character that exists through all universes.
Right.
But if he's a world eater, then like he is in the comics, then most likely every universe has that character.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see how they handle that. The only other thing I wanted to call out was I'm coming up on the last episode of The Pitt, which airs Thursdays on HBO Max. And man, I know it's not superheroes, but it is in my book, because the people who work in the ERs and in these crisis and these trauma centers are unbelievable. The doctors, the nurses, the attendings, everybody. And I can't recommend this show enough. It's so brilliantly done. It's created by some of the creators of ER, including the original actor, Noah Wiley, who plays the lead. And it has this really unique, cool format where each episode represents 1 hour in the shift of this ER. So it's a 15-hour shift and there's 15 episodes. And
while we were recording, I've gotten several texts, all from, I've got a sports text thread, and everyone's probably like, where the fuck is he going with this? Here he goes again. All of those texts, I'll tell you what it starts with. The first text I got was, holy shit, there's a blank episode of The Pit. And it is harrowing. And the whole time we've been recording, which probably explains some of, they were probably like, oh, that explains it. I've been pondering what you said about this sort of like 24 style of hour by hour by hour.
Right.
Thinking, how the hell does that work? So I'll talk to you about it off air, but I am
like
gonna
charm.
So I don't know if you know what the blank is, but the minute we get off air, I want you to tell me what you think he said. Holy shit, there's a blank episode of The Pit. It is harrowing, and I'll leave it at that, because the whole rest of the stream is them talking about it, spoiling it like a mother. But
well, I really recommend it to everybody, because it's not a typical like soap opera hospital show. There's no, you know, baby mama drama. There's no outside of the hospital life. It's simply like you're standing in the middle of this ER following these doctors around and just going from crisis and crisis to crisis. And half the time my fists are clenched when I'm watching it. My teeth are clenched. Sometimes I have to cover my eyes because it's incredibly graphic and true and realistic. And it's just wonderful performances, and it's so well written. So highly, highly recommend everybody.
And I love this for Noah Wiley, who as a young actor was in this massive serial VR and one of the continuous actors throughout all of these other people leaving, and seeing him get this opportunity to take a swing at a more authentic character on Max, where you can portray everything that you're saying in a much more realistic way, is fantastic, because he's taken some strange swings over the years in some series that I've liked and enjoyed, but haven't like made him a superstar like he was when he was in his 20s, you know, with all of these other bigger actors.
Well, this is going to put him back on. It's blowing up on social media as well.
Yeah.
And it's the other thing that's been really great is that part of the big, huge attraction and social media hype has been from the medical profession, mm-hmm. people in the medical profession, people who are saying how authentic it is, nurses, doctors that, you know, say, you know, this is so relatable. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the actors and the producers have been, they've not been distancing themselves. I saw a video clip of Noah Wiley in a hospital in Pittsburgh. I think the hospital that they modeled this after. And you can tell that there's been I think the best series always have an interconnectedness with the topic that they're covering, and this one clearly does.
Absolutely. Okay. All right. That's all. Just wanted to add that.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
All right, that is the end of our show. Join us next weekend when we cover Daredevil Born Again, Episode 8. And listen, I don't know what the name of the title is, but I know what it could be. There are two episode titles that have been thrown out into the ether that have not been used yet. So we've either got Episode 8, Isle of Joy, or Episode 8, Straight to Hell, which ironically enough, I thought was also the name of Episode 3. But, you know.
So let's take a bet. So
what's that?
And let's take a bet. Which do you think it is?
Well, it's funny because when I posted that, I was like, well, it's got to be. So initially, I would say Isle of Joy. However, I think Bernthal is going to be in this next episode.
Yeah.
And if Bernthal's in this episode, I'm going with Straight to Hell. I would say.
Yeah, I think it's Straight to Hell. I think it's Straight to Hell because the Isle of Joy is more the completion. You know what I mean? And I think Straight to Hell is, you know, he's now fully Daredevil and Fisk is fully Kingpin and we're going straight to hell. So that's my guess. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can find all of our contact information at podcastica.com, where you'll also find links to our social media pages and to all of our shows. If you'd like to send a message, you can leave a message at the Podcastica Facebook site or email or send a voice message to talk@podcastica.com.
And some of our most recent podcasting shows, I'm just going to focus on really one right now, because we are heading on April 13th is the premiere of The Last of Us in our benchmark series, which used to be called The Walking Dead Cast, is now called The Cast of Us for The Last of Us. They just re-released and I would say this is a somewhat spoilery show because it is, we have Jason and Eric talking about the game. They did their first walkthrough of the game back in 2020 when The Last of Us 2 was released, which this season is centered on. So they re-released that episode and also released an episode with, I believe it was Jason, Eric, and Ben, who are a part of the cast of us, The Last of Us season, talking about what they think is going to happen in season 2. So highly recommend the benchmark series. Did a fantastic job with the season 1, which seems like 17 years ago when it came
absolutely
out.
Absolutely fantastic. Gut-wrenching, captivating, performances off the hook, writing just riveting. The environment, the special effects, the sets.
Yeah. Well, they did. The executive producers are also the creators of the game. So as we mentioned with The Pit, it's interrelated to, they didn't step away from the game. They owned into it. So they leaned into it. So really looking forward. And having now played The Last of Us game, both part 1 and part 2, yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, and I'll leave it at that.
Very cool. And if you'd like, if you like what we do, give us a 5-star rating, a review, or a like, and follow and subscribe on Facebook, Instagram, and Patreon. You can find all of that information in our show notes, as well as podcastica.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Peace!
Seeking penance for what I've done, Father. I'm asking forgiveness for what I'm about to do.
That's not how this works. What exactly are you going to do?
To second to last, next to the Doom's, what's his name? The guy playing Doom.
Robert Downey Jr.
Robert Downey Jr.
Well, our brain power is just,
oh my God.
And there are people listening right now that are like, these guys,
they're so
these guys
old
are gonna
and
save
so demented.
You don't think that we're going to say, okay, but
I was going to send in a comment, but fuck that.